Stephen Smith, Real One. Stephen, could I ask you about the sort of founding of Beth Shalom and how this came about? You know, first of all, something about yourself, where you were born and brought up, and the sort of background.
I was born in Derbyshire, 1967. I was born into the home of a Methodist minister and a school teacher. My mother taught religious education in grammar school in Derby, in Ashbourne, Derbyshire. And when I was just about school age, my family moved to North Nottinghamshire for my father's work. And I suppose I was brought up in the North Nottinghamshire coalfields. We lived in a pit village called Ollerton. And that is where I went to school, first of all to the primary school, then to the secondary school in Ollerton. And I grew up in an environment in which, because of my parents' work, because my father being a minister meant it was something of a family occupation, because of my parents' work, I grew up in an environment in which religion was a part of our everyday lives. And I suppose our family would have very much demonstrated at that time a commitment to Christianity and to the principles of Christianity, and I suppose we would have described ourselves as probably conservative evangelical Protestants, if the pigeonhole is necessary. When I was about 11 years old, my parents decided that while they continued to be committed to their work within the Christian church, they wanted a more, a broader platform to work. My mother was particularly interested in counselling, and we found that our home became a focus of a lot of activity, and they decided that it would be good to broaden their perspective, and they decided to set up a small conference centre. I suppose in the Christian tradition that's generally termed a retreat, because the idea was to provide conference facilities mainly for Christian churches and for individuals. And so my parents bought an old Victorian farmhouse in the North Nottinghamshire countryside, a somewhat tumbled down, derelict old place, with the idea that it would create a small centre for Christian people to use for conferences and retreats and so on. So, at the age of 11, that's where we moved to, and once again, our home became the centre of various activities. But this move proved to be quite interesting, because until this point, my parents had been linked to the Methodist Church. At the point at which they launched out on their own, they became somewhat more independent. I suppose one would describe them as interdenominational. The result was that I grew up in an environment which was religious without being limited to one perspective or another. Then in 1981, I suppose, in March 1981, we took a family holiday to Israel. My parents decided it would be interesting to visit the Holy Land to get an idea of where our Christian background was situated. And so we went off to the Holy Land and very quickly discovered Israel in its very many varied dimensions. An Israel which presented us with more questions than it did answers. Again, I was very fortunate to have parents who were not generally following the crowd, and they decided not to go on a coach tour of the Holy Land, but to go and explore, and we did it under our own steam, and we ended up finding ourselves at more Jewish sites than we did at sites of the origins of Christianity. I remember one particular incident. It was a Friday afternoon, Erev Shabbat in the Jewish tradition. We found ourselves at the Kotel, at the western wall of the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem, the old city. And there was this buzz of activity, and I remember thinking to myself, How is it we come here to learn about our Christian tradition and the origins and roots of Christianity, and when we see it, as in Judaism being practiced today, we don't understand it? So, I remember also thinking, if we come here to learn about Jesus of Nazareth and his life and his, the kind of person he was and where it all came from, surely you have to understand Judaism and the life and the history of the Jewish people to understand where Christianity came from. So it was really only, I suppose, a set of questions and a point of departure for future curiosity. But after that visit to Israel, we did take an interest as a family, a little bit more in things Jewish. I seem to remember a few weeks later having chicken pox and sitting reading books like The Chosen and The Promise and My Name's Ashalev by Chaim Potok. Books about the dilemma of Jewish identity in the 20th century and finding the whole fascinating world, really. Okay, what happened was I chose to do an A-level in religious studies and chose Judaism as my special topic because of this interest, and again found it fascinating to learn more about the history and tradition of the Jewish people. I ended up doing an undergraduate degree in Christian theology, and I particularly took an interest again in the emergence of Christianity. I focused in the 400 years prior to and following the emergence of Christianity, and in that, again, I began to understand that to understand the Christian world, you had to understand its Jewish origins. I began to see Western Christian civilization as a fusion of Greek philosophy and Semitic monotheism and ethical monotheism, and began to realize that this that in fact we tend not to focus so much on the Semitic side of Western Christian civilization. I felt that was something of a miss. But I also became concerned, and that I noticed with growing concern, that the emergence of anti-Semitism as we know it today stems back to that early period. That fueled my interest in anti-Semitism and the Jewish-Christian relationship. So, somewhat naively, I decided to look at a postgraduate project on some aspects around theological responses to the Holocaust. I was particularly interested in how the Christian world had responded to the fact that 6 million Jews were murdered because, and only because they were Jews, within the context of the so-called Western civilized Christian world. So that's what I set out to try and learn a little bit about in July 1991. James, my brother, and I went to Israel again for the summer. James was a medical student and spent his summer working at Hadassah Hospital in Jerusalem. I spent my time doing a Hebrew language course at the University in Jerusalem, and we went to Yad Vashem. We had been to Yad Vashem before as tourists on our previous visit, but this time we went asking ourselves the question, what does the watch of the Holocaust mean to us? What is our responsibility, that is to say, following the destruction of European Jewry, not as Jews, therefore not facing a personal identity issue or crisis, not as Germans over 65 years old feeling culpable or being guilty for the crimes themselves, but asking ourselves, what does this mean to us as non-Jewish young professionals in Britain at the end of the 20th century in the light of the fact that genocide happened on our doorstep in the lifetime of our parents? That was our question. We came away moved by what we saw. We also came away challenged. There wasn't really a dilemma, but there was a choice. We found ourselves facing the choice of either leaving Yad Vashem and saying, you know, that was a terrible tragedy, it really should not have happened, but anyway, let's carry on with our lives anyway. Or saying to ourselves, this was a tragedy, it should not have happened, why did it happen, and could such things happen again? More importantly, asking ourselves, if we're true to ourselves, can we carry on with our lives as if that's all okay? I say it wasn't a dilemma because it was a very simple choice to make. We could not leave Yad Vashem, but otherwise feel other than the sense of responsibility of being young professionals in the post-Holocaust period and knowing that this was not dim and distant history but was a part of our present. Two of the things we felt together for shame, we felt that the Holocaust was not a Jewish problem. We felt very clearly that the Jewish community was apparent, suffering the consequences of Nazi genocidal policy, continues to suffer the burden of that very, very painful past. However, we felt that the problem lay fairly and squarely outside of a Jewish context and therefore needs to be addressed by non-Jewish people, and obviously not exclusively, but in partnership with the Jewish community, and that non-Jewish people need to take the responsibility of addressing those issues. We also felt that history was not about events, dates, times, facts and places in the past, but history is about the interpretation of those events. And we felt that people were all too willing to whitewash, to ignore, to sweep under the carpet very pressing issues which were staring us clearly in the face. And we felt that we had a responsibility to contribute to the interpretation of that history. We had no big aspirations. We simply felt that somebody should do something about this. We knew that in our country, because of our interest, that there hadn't been a big focus on the Holocaust. We knew we'd gone through our education system, but secondary and higher education, that nobody had raised this, even though we'd been interested. That we found frustrating. But we felt that what we should do is at least channel some of our energy and some of our, what we felt were insights at any rate at this point, in just trying to stimulate some kind of further interest. We particularly felt this was important for non-Jews. We particularly felt it was important in an educational setting. But we were not thinking of doing anything ourselves. We simply thought that somebody should do something. So we came back and we talked to various people, nobody in particular, but to family, to friends, to associates, to people in various walks of life, and said, you know, this is a really pressing issue. Somebody really should be doing something about this. And the kind of responses we were getting were, yes, you know, you're absolutely right. This is a very important issue. Somebody should do something about this. And after a few months, we realized that we were saying the same as everyone else, that somebody should do something, but weren't taking the role itself. We did not feel in any way, shape or form qualified or competent, or even, what's the word, I don't know that we felt we should do something directly, because we knew this was very close to other people's hearts, as victims, as survivors, as the families of people who went through this. But nevertheless, the more we thought about it, the more we felt we should do something. We thought we might set up a small library or have a few pictures on the wall or something. And we turned to my mother. My father had basically retired by this time. Mother was running the centre here at a small conference centre still, and we said to her, you know, there's plenty of conference centres, retreats, whatever, where people can go to focus on whatever it is they're interested in, but there is nowhere where people can go to think about the Holocaust and its implications. Particularly, I think, still we were concerned about the fact that within a nominal Christian environment, nominal Christians and committed Christians alike were not taking this seriously, but this is something that needed to challenge the Christian world, and by that I'm not talking about practicing Christians, but the environment in which all of us live in Britain, which, whether or not people practice, is nominally Christian, or at least it has the foundation of a Christian culture. But that challenge remains within that environment. We also felt it was important that such a place should bring people together from all kinds of backgrounds to address their roles and responsibilities. I would like to mention one other key moment in the development of this idea. People have said to us in discussion and conversation, you know, if you're interested in this, you should really go to Poland to visit the places where these things happen, to get a sense of what happened to whom and where. So in the winter of 91-92, I think it was January 92, we took the car and we drove through Germany, the Czech Republic, into Poland and back. We visited sites of the development of National Socialism. We visited Prague and the old Jewish quarter to view the terrorists in, and we went to Krakow and, of course, to Auschwitz. Our journey then took us on through Lodz, Warsaw, back through Berlin. But of particular importance was our visit to Auschwitz. It was a profoundly moving experience, but one which, again, left us with many, many questions. We particularly found ourselves realizing that Auschwitz was not about numbers, but was about individuals. People had said, you know, Poland is like a large Jewish cemetery, and I'm understanding at the end of the ramp at Auschwitz, a place where over a million Jewish people passed on their way to death in the gas chambers at Auschwitz-Birkenau. And I remember thinking, this is no cemetery. Of course, it's the final resting place of over a million people, so in that sense, I suppose it is. But in a cemetery, you visit the individual graves of individual people. There are names, there are dates of birth, there are dates of death, there is dignity, there is honour, there is memory. And where are those things at Auschwitz? I also remember, and you can then take that on Treblinka, Sobibor, Helmno, Majdanek, Belzec. You can apply it to sites of mass execution like Wielkopolska Góra. You can apply it to all kinds of places where people lost their lives in total anonymity. It became clear the final solution to the Jewish question was not just about the mass murder, the genocide of the Jews of Europe, but was also focused on the obfuscation of the memory of the fact that those people ever existed. I think also, I went through my mind, the rites of Jewish death and mourning. You know, what happens when a Jewish person dies? And I thought about the way in which people were separated, parted, murdered, cremated. The way in which, you know, every last vestige of the dignity that those people had was desecrated. Everything they stood for as Jews, whether they were religious or they were not, was desecrated at the point at which they were murdered. And I realised you can't call those places a cemetery. What I think we also felt and shared was that whatever we should create here, in the place that we were thinking of creating, should first and foremost be a place of memorial. That it should have as a main feature a sense of dignity and honour, and just to say we understand that the people whom we are talking were murdered without memory. I think also what came as a big shock was travelling around the Polish countryside with a little guidebook, I don't even remember what it was now, but some kind of guide that, you know, gave an introduction to the Jewish community that was there when it was founded, how many people were there at the eve of the outbreak of war, and I think what really hit home was the fact that those communities are no longer there. Not only are they no longer there, but by and large there's no trace of the fact that they were there. I'm not nostalgic about this period of Jewish history. I have no right to be because I don't remember it. It isn't a part of my own history. But what I do know is that there was a vibrant civilization there, a Yiddish culture which it was not pleasant actually, but it was thriving. You know, those people had their lives, they had their culture, they had their civilization, and it's just like as if it never existed. And again, I think that prompted us to really think that what we should do here is not attempt to bring that back, you can't, but at least to respect the fact it was there, and to highlight the fact it was there, and that now it is not. Because you don't understand genocide, you can't understand the Holocaust, unless you understand what, and I would emphasise who, was lost. And therefore, we really felt that we should make it part of our duty to do that. So we came back from our visit to Poland, aware that there was a developing concept of both the duty and the responsibility. duty of remembrance and the responsibility of education. At this time I was studying at the Hebrew Centre for the Postgraduate Centre for Hebrew Studies at Yarmouth in Oxford, with a postgraduate year there to think about it, all of this, and to work through it. And during that year the idea of the development of Echelon came about, and what we should be applying here and so on.
Did you at this stage have any guide? I mean, what was there about in the way of Holocaust memorial museums? You've mentioned Yad Vashem, of course, in Israel. But, you know, to look at it from a European
perspective. I spent a considerable amount of time, actually, travelling around various sites of and museums in Europe. Bergen-Belsen, Dachau, and places like this. Went back to Poland two or three times. Spent considerable time in Israel at Yad Vashem and Lochmer Aget Ot. I went to no less than 12 Holocaust centres in the United States of America. One of my biggest regrets is that I lost my notebook on the way home. I left it on the plane, and still today it would make a wonderful paper and an even better book, because it was a fascinating experience seeing the Holocaust from so many different perspectives. And then I was so involved in developing this place, came up with so many ideas, I never really got to rewrite down my thoughts, which I'd so carefully kept on my way around. But no, I really felt it was important to learn from other people's strengths and weaknesses, because both exist. I can say with a fair degree of certainty that Bechelon is no plagiarisation of any one place, but I suppose it has my experiences from a number of different places which I imbibed have surely come out, although I couldn't pinpoint any one place and say it's like that or the other. It has a bit of Yad Vashem in it. I also have a lot of respect for Lochmer Aget Ot, the place of focused learning. It has aspects of a number of American and European centres, simply because I visited those places and learned from them. But I was also aware that there was something quite unique about what we were creating. I knew that very few centres had been created outside the Jewish community, and that was unique in its own right, apart from sort of federal organisations like the US Holocaust Museum. We also made a decision that we were not going to approach the Jewish community for funding for the centre. We felt it was important that at least the point at which we opened Bechelon should come from a desire from non-Jewish people to see it happen. We had a certain amount of funding towards the development of the premises, and we had to obviously find extra, and we had to go to family, to friends, to associates, to small foundations and so on, to try and piece together these several hundreds of thousands of pounds that we needed. That came slowly, actually. We also made considerable savings over our original budget by doing as much as we could ourselves. James and I designed the museum and put the majority of the work into our research. We also did it in our own time and our own resources. So, we saved a lot. We were also very pleased to, that some local people and friends and so on volunteered in helping to put things together, and we got quite adept at doing quite a lot of things that we never dreamt of doing. But it was the only way to do it that we felt was meaningful. We felt, we didn't have big aspirations. We just wanted to do something meaningful. We thought it would have local or at least regional relevance, but we hoped that people further afield would see its significance. But we weren't after we weren't after significance. We just wanted to get it right. And in fact, at one point we sat down and said, "What happens if no one comes to this place? Here we are in the middle of the field, in the middle of nothing. What happens if no one comes? Miles away from the Jewish community. And while we're happy for the Jewish community to come and participate and hopefully partnership, enter into partnership with us." Nevertheless, our main audience would rather be educational groups and universities, and are we going to find there's a reticence to deal with the topic? So it was very much dealing with an unknown. we actually said to ourselves, well, you know, it doesn't really matter. If people come, then fine. If they don't, then also fine. The most important thing is that we do it. Which was right and wrong, actually, because it was right insofar as if we hadn't done it, it wouldn't be here. It was wrong insofar as we do need people to come, because the place only has a life of its own when it's being contributed to by visitors and seminars and discussion and group work and so on. Another decision along the way was that we should not simply be a museum. Well, two things we felt we should not be. One was a monument, and two was a museum. We didn't want to be a monument because creating a monument in the middle of the rural England would run the risk of achieving the very opposite of what we set out to achieve. To explain, if we created a monument which was very meaningful to us and to a few people now, the chances are, with the passage of time, with a generation, people would come along and say, well, that's very nice, but you know, why is it here? For a start, 1,000 miles away from something that happened to people who had nothing to do with this area, surely that's got no significance to us. Second reason we didn't want to create a monument is that generally monuments tend to diminish in their meaning with the passage of time. Of course, there are monuments of national significance that don't, but by and large, monuments tend to mean less and less to future generations simply because the passage of time does that. Therefore, we felt we wanted to create a place, a memorial place, that would have as its main focus education. So that as time goes by, hopefully more and more people are informed by it. But I also mentioned we decided not to be a museum because we didn't want to simply add to awareness of the Holocaust. If people want to be aware, at this moment in time there are plenty of books in print, there are plenty of documentaries on the television, there are plenty of newspaper articles about the Holocaust and its impact in contemporary society. Awareness is not the issue. We felt that the issue was providing a framework for focused educational group work, that's the way to put it. A place where people could come in relatively small numbers and to talk in more depth and to discuss in more depth what the Holocaust means to them and to explore the questions more than to find the answers. We were particularly aware of the fact that we are in a tourist area in Shirley Forest and that we could make use of the large number of people that come through. The people could do the world of Robin Hood in the morning and come to us in the afternoon, but that was not what we wanted to achieve. We wanted to achieve a place that would have focus as a place of education. Our resources came from a variety of places. We used archives in Israel, in Poland mainly, some American archives. And we try to draw a spectrum of materials from as wide a possible range of experiences as possible. Our museum is no more than 1,600 square feet, which for anybody involved in museum work or interested in spaces, actually will know very quickly that's a very small amount of space. So the challenge was how to get so much material into so little space. We wanted to create a place that would reflect on a Jewish life before the war, on community living, on the people that were to become its victims, and we wanted to create a place that would first of all set the context for what was to come.